First of all, I'd like to thank the UCLA Downtown Labor Center and Kent Wong for graciously hosting this and putting this together very short notice. And Jerry Acosta, whom many of you may know, he's the Deputy Director of the Western Region of the AFL-CIO. And I'm sure it's going to emerge in this discussion. I already see some of you with a pamphlet at the back raising some of the concerns about the relationship with the AFL-CIO and the opposition to President Chavez and the coup in particular. And that is bound to come up, I'm sure, in the discussion. So I really want to thank Jerry for being accountable and talking to all the people that he needed to talk to and pull the strings that he needed to pull and really to get on board as the Western region of the AFL-CIO and also the Los Angeles County Federation of Labor. But on to Sharmini Perez. We have been in touch and learning a bit more about Sharmini's very important work in the Presidential Palace, where she is the International Relations Advisor to President Hugo Chavez of Venezuela. She works out of Miraflores and advises the President on foreign policy. So I'm very, very delighted to introduce to you Sharmini Perez.
Great pleasure to be here, and I certainly have to begin with thanking Global Women's Strike for organizing this meeting and also to thank the UCLA Labor Center and, of course, the AFL-CIO and Mr. Acosta for being here. I'm going to begin by locating myself because this is an interesting story. I'm not Venezuelan. And it's an interesting story how I wound up in Venezuela. I was actually, for 15, 20 years, I've been working in the area of human rights, including labor rights, women's rights, anti-racism work internationally. I'm originally from Sri Lanka, and I've been doing a lot of international work. I was a journalist for Frontline India, and I was working on a series which was titled Latin America in Revolt Against the U.S. Empire. And in the process, I was going around interviewing various social movement leaders and political leaders in Latin America for this series I was doing way across on the other side of the world for Frontline India, which is one of the most progressive left-wing journals, the most widely circulated in India itself and in Asia, but a progressive journal nonetheless. And in the process, I went to interview President Hugo Chavez. He's, of course, much in demand around the world at this moment for interviews in terms of journalists. So I waited around for a couple of weeks waiting for him to finally give me an interview. And one very interesting day last February, when it was a very heated climate in Caracas, where there was an opposition demonstration being planned and a Chavista demonstration being planned at the same time. And it was tense because the time before that when it happened, it was really during the 2002 coup d'etat on April 11th. So it was a very tense situation. And that very day, the climate was so bad that the president decided to call an international press conference and have all of the journalists come in just to calm the situation down and also to draw international attention to what was going on. So on that particular day, I also got my interview with the president, which led to this situation I'm in now, which is working for him. Yes, it turned out to be a job interview. I thought I was interviewing him and he was interviewing me. So here I am. So for the last 14 months or more, I've been working for President Chavez. The reason I was doing this series for Frontline India is because I was following the trend of the U.S. empire. Since Latin America was the first laboratory of the U.S. empire, where globalization and neoliberal policies of the world was being experimented, our hunch in Asia was the first revolt against this was actually going to come from Latin America. And in 1987, the Caracaso in Venezuela, which some of you might know about, it was where the government of the day was introducing structural adjustment and World Bank and IMF policies. And tons of people, the poor was really out of work, factories were closing, and there was a mass demonstration of the poor About 20,000 of them descended from the barrios into the streets of Caracas. There was massive protests against neoliberalism, structural adjustment policies of the government. And it's famously called the Caracazo, and it's really the first anti-globalization demonstration of that proportion in the world, because that was before the uprisings in Chiapas. It was before a lot of the other anti-globalization action. It is the first one that we know of that was clearly articulating a resistance to neoliberal policies, the U.S. empire, and globalization strategies in the world. So this was very interesting to us, and we were following this trend when I ended up in Venezuela. And why I am there is because I still believe that what is happening in Latin America in general and what is happening in Venezuela in particular is a world-class example of how we can challenge and counter the global trends we are seeing. And what we saw in Seattle, in Genova, in Quebec City, these protests grew out of some of what was coming out of Latin America and continues to do so through Organization of the World Social Forum, various other things. And another thing is, in Latin America, in the next year, there's going to be 9 elections. And all of these elections may be electing, at least if we are to believe the polls and the indicators, may be electing left-wing governments. So, in one form or another. And of course, President Hugo Chavez's policies will stand up as an example. And if it can succeed, it will be an example that other countries can rely on, saying that they can do something different than what the U.S. empire, U.S. companies, and the World Bank and the IMF are trying to dictate to them. So the survival of Venezuela, its process, its revolutionary goals, becomes pivotal, becomes so important for the rest of the world, for Latin America and for the rest of the world. So that is why I'm there in Venezuela, being a non-Venezuelan, because it's utterly important for the rest of the world. Now, what is unique about the U.S. empire? It's that the United States of America is the only colony in the world that became an empire itself. And the expansion of the U.S. empire around the world is something for us to really contend with, to get to understand, to challenge in ways that we have never thought about before. Because of this unique, you know, being a colony and then becoming an empire, it has really various features that we need to get hold on and understand better. I don't think it has ever been so clear to people, this kind of U.S. empire and its expansionist ideas. First, it moved into Latin America. As I said, it was the first laboratory. Then to the Pacific, to Vietnam, Philippines, etc., etc., before it started moving into Africa, Asia, and Europe, and so on. So keeping that in mind, always in our background, we need to unpack the U.S. empire and the influence that they are having around the world and find out ways in which we can counter it. One of the things that is for me really encouraging about LA and the various labor movements here is that I think when it comes to Venezuela, this is where some of the challenges have actually come from. Well, we all know the history of the AFL-CIO and its affiliations with the U.S. government, its administration, its history in Latin America, which I don't want to go over because you probably know most of that more than I do. But what is interesting about LA is that, or California at large, is that you guys have been putting up a challenge within your own labor movement as members, as affiliates, and so on, about the position of, say, the AFL-CIO on Venezuela. Now, that has a unique history. And how many of you follow Venezuela on a regular basis? What's been going on? Quite a few of you. That's wonderful. That's actually such a good thing. But let me give you a couple of interesting facts. How many of you know about NED, the National Endowment for Democracy? And how many of you know what percentage of the AFL-CIO, CIA, budget actually comes from NED? You know how much of your budget comes from NED?
I can't remember the exact percent.
For the record. Okay, well, people jokingly calls the AFL-CIO the AFL-CIA. And I don't particularly want to get into all the details, but there are some specific matter related to Venezuela that is interesting. The major union organization in Venezuela, CTV, as a labor union affiliated with the Fedecameras, affiliated with the oil oligarchy, affiliated with the business sector of Venezuela, played a very important role in the coup d'etat of President Chavez in April 2002. Their role was very interesting. They essentially ended up organizing a national oil strike. The National Endowment for Democracy, which is an organization which is supported by the Democrats and the Republicans in Senate, and they get their money to fund all kinds of international activities around the world, allocated some $154,000 to be given to CTV 2 years before the coup d'etat. The year before the coup d'etat, they funded CTV, the union, $257,000 to organize activities which are supposedly related to the elections and so on within the union. But the year of the coup d'etat, they tripled that figure to $877,000. And that is the year of the coup in order to organize a national strike against Hugo Chavez's government. If you plot where the money is coming from, it's coming directly from NED to CTV and the AFL-CIO. It's directly related to the allocation, monitoring, and also through the Solidarity Center assisting. So in terms of Hugo Chavez's government, you can see why he's resisting the administration at large, and even organizations like yours in particular, in terms of what is happening in Venezuela and the level of interference. And why is this interference so profound to Venezuela? Because it's interfering with the heart of Venezuela, because it is the oil industry that keep it pumping. Oil is in the blood of the country. That's how it survives. It doesn't have an infrastructure of the kind you do here. It's a country that for 80 years have not had a taxation system. Companies haven't paid their taxes. Individuals don't pay taxes. It lives and breathes oil in order to survive. So when the oil sector is shut down, using the labor movement in one way, and on the management side, out of the 20 largest oil companies working in Venezuela, 15 of them are U.S. companies. So you got Exxon, Standard, all of them. Not only are they there now, they have been there for the last 80 years. They control the intellectual property, the surveys. The American oil companies have more information about the reserves and holds all the intellectual property of the Venezuelan oil reserves. Now, being the third largest supplier to the United States, you can see why the administration is very hung up on what Hugo Chavez will and will not do in Venezuela, and why they attempt to throw him out through a coup d'etat, why they're assisting the opposition, which is a minority in Venezuela, and why they're making every effort to destabilize the oil sector so they can gain control of it. And why is Hugo Chavez not popular with the administration? Because, mind you, they made an attempt to seduce him. In 1998, when President Hugo Chavez was first elected, and he was actually president-elect, the Clinton administration invited him to come to the United States of America. He went and met Clinton. He went to Wall Street. You know, he did that big bong and opened Wall Street in the morning. He's a big fan of baseball, so he went to a Mets game. He's a pitcher. He threw the first pitch. And he was welcomed by the business sector. He was wined and dined in private dinners and so on. And all of this actually was arranged by somebody named Gustavo Cisneros. Who knows Gustavo Cisneros?
You're Cuban-American.
Cuban-American with enormous amount of wealth, owns most of AOL, Time, Latin America, owns most of the industries and a large portion of the Amazon in Venezuela. He has so much real estate in Venezuela. He's really the opposition to Hugo Chavez, but he doesn't live in Venezuela. He lives in Florida. And he owns most of the beverage industry, entertainment industry. One of my first stories I did in Venezuela was on this Cisneros. He paid $200 in taxes in Venezuela in 2000. He paid $150 in 1999. He paid no taxes in 2002 and 2003. Venezuela imports 75% of his food because it's a country totally dependent on the oil sector, doesn't grow very much. It imports its food, and over 80% of that sector is owned by Cisneros. And to even entrench that idea further, well, during the August referendum, which most of you might know, the Venezuelan constitution is the only constitution in the world that allows a midterm referendum on a presidency. And I know you guys in LA knows about referendums. Venezuela is the only constitution in the world, you know, where people can actually ask for a referendum on the presidency. And the opposition collected enough votes to have that referendum when we had a referendum in August. But prior to the referendum, Jimmy Carter, our famous ex-president here, who has that Carter Election Monitoring Center, who was monitoring the elections in Venezuela and realized how polarized the situation is, how dangerous it is. And he said, you know, President Chavez, I want to meet with you and the opposition. We really have to get a grip on the polarization of this discussion, debate, what's happening in the media in Venezuela. And I would like for both of you to come to the same table so we can have a discussion around this in the interest of peace, in the interest of transparent referendum, et cetera, et cetera. So President Chavez said, yes, sure. And who did the opposition send to negotiate? Not the elected member of the General Assembly, the political opposition, but Cisneros. So it makes it very crystal clear who's against President Chavez. Cisneros is very well connected to the Bush administration. It's very well connected to the Clinton administration. It has a lot of money. It has a lot of influence in Venezuela. And most of the oil oligarchy elite is affiliated with that opposition. And so that's the political picture in Venezuela. So then getting back to the AFL-CIO, it becomes really clear that some of the policy that the organization has taken on Venezuela is to be contested because of the certain threads it has to the Bush administration, to the CIA, to the ways in which NED and USAID is funding the organization to influence activities in Venezuela. And we can provide you with more evidence of that. But what's encouraging here, as I said earlier, is that the biggest resistance about policy at the AFL-CIO is coming from California. And why is that so? I'd like to get a better understanding of that. What is it about California? What is it about the membership here? What is it about Mr. Acosta's regional membership that is posing that challenge, and how can we best utilize this opportunity we have to do what we all want, which is a progressive labor movement, which is a labor movement that actually supports progressive activity in Latin America, and not to assist and abide and aid the U.S. administration at the moment. And so I'd like to, you know, pose some questions to you in that what is so unique about it, and what are the opportunities here that we could take advantage of, that could help us take better positions, that could help us organize, that could help us assist in giving you more information, and so on. That's one area that I would like to talk to you about, and I'm interested in hearing some feedback. I want to talk about what is, besides the external forces and the challenges that Chavez has in staying alive as a government, the other thing is all the great things that are happening in Venezuela. And in the short time that I have been there, I've noticed so many wonderful things that are going on in Venezuela that's not happening anywhere in the world. And some of them are interesting. One is the greatest challenge being literacy. Any progressive society needs an educated and literate population. Venezuela, under Chavez's government, 3 years ago adopted a literacy program that we borrowed from the Cubans, really. It has, according to UNESCO, effectively gotten rid of illiteracy in the country within a period of 3 years. Now, this is something that World Bank and IMF and all the development agencies around the world has not been able to achieve anywhere else in the world, not in a period of 3 years, not in a period of 10 years. So now we have grandmothers learning to read and write for the first time. And you can see on any given day, one of the exercises in some of these literacy classes is to write letters. And some of these older women, they're so excited about learning to read and write that Chavez has stacks of letters like this from grandmothers and older women in these courses because they're so excited about the fact that they're learning to read and write for the first time. But anyway, that's a success story. Another program is the Barrio Dentros. Venezuela doesn't have enough doctors to service its population, and particularly not in poor areas, in the rural areas, in the barrios. We have a program, again, this is with the Cubans, a big no-no, but Cuba has provided us with 18,000 doctors that are all working in the rural areas and in the poor neighborhoods and barrios, and these are dentists, these are specialists of various kinds, eye doctors, dentists, GPs, and so on. And not only are they working in the poor and rural areas, they're also going out to the very elite and remote areas like the Amazon. They're helicoptered in or they're flown into indigenous communities that haven't had medical attention for years and years and years. And now the Cuban doctors are going there on a regular two-week cycle in order to service the populations there. And this has never happened in Venezuela. And it's not something that we're going to depend on forever because some of these doctors are actually at the Bolivarian universities, which is another program implemented by Chavez, where university education is free and accessible for the poor and they're done. In 12 different universities across the country called Bolivarian universities. Now, universities in Venezuela has always been public and they've always been free, but they've been public and free for a particular group of Venezuelans who actually had connections in the universities, and if they got in, their education was free. But for the first time, it's university education is free for everybody. And even if you don't have a high school degree, there is another mission that actually trains and it's a program in order to get students who didn't finish school or dropped out or whatever. Once they finish this program, it's a transition program, they are automatically admitted to the Bolivarian University. So access to university education for all those who want it and need it, who does this program, it's available to them now. And so in the next 2 years, the Bolivarian universities will actually be graduating doctors that could take up the positions that the Cuban doctors are currently occupying. This is another incredible effort called Misiones, these social programs. They're part of the Chavez Revolution and they're being implemented. Its results are going to take a bit more time. But what is unique about all these programs is that the national oil company, PDVSA, funds all the Misiones. So in terms of an example of corporate social responsibility, there's nothing like it in the world than PDVSA. It's struggling, it's learning to do this model, but it is where national resources of the country, in this case oil, and the revenues generated from it is directly going back into the population and enhancement, development, healthcare, social well-being of the population through the national oil company. And why is Chavez using the oil company to do this? Because currently we don't have control of our national Venezuelan central bank. Central bank constitutionally is supposed to be this hands-off where the government has no control of its activities. It's supposed to be this hands-off organization. It's very strange. Nowhere is this the case. But over the last so many years, the central bank has developed certain policies around itself to insulate it from any government influence. So therefore, right now, Chavez is having a hard time getting the central bank to release its money so that he can use it for national programs. That's why he's had to use the PDVSA of the oil company's money so directly, because he wants to get it to the people as quickly as possible. And just recently, we've introduced some legislation in parliament in order to change the way that the central bank behaves. Nowhere else in the world does the ruling party or ruling government has no control over their national central bank. I don't know any other example in the world where that is the case. So Chavez has introduced some legislation to make this possible. It's being resisted. It's being resisted not just by the opposition in the country. It's being resisted by external forces. And that's the sad dilemma about it. Luckily, Chavez has so much support in the National Assembly. We have majority of the assembly members. So likely this regulation is going to pass and we will have greater control. But the Central Bank of Venezuela has behaved like a private company. It has taken all its reserves, all its revenue, and invested it abroad, not in the country. 80% of the National Bank's revenues, 80% of its reserve, is invested outside of the country, in Miami, in Europe, and other places, but not in the country. It's a strange way for a national bank to reserve. But these are some of the challenges he's facing. And I think the misiones that are happening there, they're an interesting alternative, but it can't remain misiones for very much longer. The other great big challenge for the Chavez government is the state itself. The state is in the process of being restructured, reorganized in order to implement revolutionary policies. But it is nowhere near capable and able to meet that challenge right now because, like any other state, it's gotten used to behaving a particular way. Corruption, cultural practices of these state apparatuses has become a real impediment for the Chavez process. And let me give you an example. The identification cards, passports, and so on, which is a universal right to have identity documents and to be able to travel and so on. In Venezuela, the elite, the oil-affiliated sector has been traveling and having a lot of privileges and having these documents and so on. But when Chavez took power, 60% of the people living in barrios were undocumented. And yet they needed documentation to go to school, to have health care, to have just basic services extended to them. And they didn't have these identification cards. And you go on any day at the ministry where you get your ID documents, and there's a huge lineup, about 1,600 people waiting in a lineup. And recently I found out that even to get in the lineup to get your ID card, you have to bribe one of the security people, 1,800 bolivars or 1,500 bolivars. The corruption, state corruption, has been so pervasive in the country that it still exists. Chavez, all these years, has not been able to eradicate those kinds of processes because he has enough opposition at the moment. He doesn't need to be pissing off the security guards, you know. So it's been a challenge getting the culture, state infrastructures, the culture to change, to have good practices, to behave in ethical ways. It's going to take. One of my professors told me it's going to take a generation to build a state infrastructure of the kind that Chavez is imagining. So it's a struggle. But what Chavez has decided to do and what the cabinet has decided to do is to have these misiones, which I call bypass surgery, because we're not using the state infrastructure to actually deliver these things. We are using quick, small projects in order to get these services to the people as quickly as possible. And so what is Chavez doing? He's actually having these military units, and I'll get to this in a moment, military, young military personnel in mobile registration centers going out to the barrios, going out to the rural areas, and these are young men on the spot registering people with their birth certificates and so on, whatever documentation they can get. All they need is two local authorities to give them a letter saying they're a member of this family and they, you know, they've known them from birth or whatever, to get their ID cards. And we're registering something like 100,000 people every month using this mobile registration centers to give people a basic human right, which they're entitled to, while people going to the ministry is still lining up and waiting for their documents. So this is one way of doing it. But unfortunately, these systems, these alternative systems, what I call bypass surgery, has to at some point become a part of the state apparatus. And it's just not ready to internalize those programs, not yet, because the system is still so corrupt. If not corrupt, it's anti-Chavista. So there is bureaucratic hurdles for people to get through in order to get basic services in the ministries. And another thing I just want to say is that a unique feature about Venezuela is that the military, which we probably all sort of go, Latin American military who wants to deal with them. But Venezuelan military is very unique. I was a reporter who covered war zones, so my distaste for military is sort of in my blood. And when I first went to Venezuela, I was shocked at the number of military that was around. I mean, it was a very intense time when I was first there. But I noticed that I step out of my hotel and there's military guards everywhere. But then it took me a few weeks to realize that there's really a wonderful harmony between the military and the people in Venezuela. It's not something that they resist off the bat. And that is because the military in Venezuela has a unique training. Not only are there security personnel, they're also social agents of social development. They've been trained to also do community development, driving around in the rural areas. And you could often find military personnel helping the farmers pick the coffee beans because it's, you know, suddenly coffee, it's time to harvest and they don't have enough labor. And then military units pick the coffee beans. Now you find military personnel building hospitals, building health clinics, building daycares. They're emergency service personnel, not because there's a mudslide or a hurricane, but they're also for smaller heavy rains in an area, and the military is dispatched to assist the people to move and things like that. So the harmony between the people and the military is a unique feature in Venezuela that I'm still starting to understand, really, in many ways. I don't quite understand it, but I know that they do a particular service. Just outside of Caracas, there is a military base called Secular Militar. And every Saturday morning, there's a farmers market. Farmers and indigenous farmers come in from all over the countryside, and they set up a farmers market. There is a ID clinic, there's a health clinic, there is horse rides for the children, there is always a concert in the evening, and people from all over the city go to this. You know, it's not just a thing for the military families and whoever lives there, but it is a community, it's a venue for the community to come together. And I've never seen that, you know, and I first resisted going there, and then I realized, wow, it's a great place to go do your weekly shopping, and it's everything so fresh. And then I realized there's a lot more going there. Oh, they also have a milk bar. Anybody can go there and drink all the milk they want. So these are some of the unique things about Venezuela. Although I wanted to have a conversation with the labor community here to get some ideas from you in terms of what is helpful. I'm not a labor activist, but I'd like to get an idea from you all as to, you know, what is it that you need in order to sort of help and support the great work that you're already doing in terms of providing a challenge to your national organization.
Why don't we open it up for either questions or discussion, and then I would very much like to focus on this issue that Charmini would like to talk about, and that is how we might be able to more effectively change the national policy of the FLCIO with regard to their work in Venezuela. And I think that's a critical issue on the table.
So, who's trying to go first?
Please.
I'm not part of the international department or have been active in the International Affairs Solidarity Center's work. I do know that in some places, like Colombia and other places, the Solidarity Department plays a crucial role in assisting workers and providing educational opportunities. I'm not here to argue, to challenge, or to support the circumstances in Venezuela. I am here, however, to figure out how, as regional director of the deputy director of the AFL-CIO and potential future regional director of the Southwest region, how staff, union members can help expand the dialogue and the interaction. The problem with us is that we never come up for air. As union leaders, we fight our executive boards, we fight our companies, we fight our staff, we fight corporate America, and we don't ever really get engaged and involved in this international scene that's imperative now for us. Because I've been to Colombia and I've seen our future. So I think just as there was a program where AFL-CIO staff, leaders of central labor councils and state feds reached out and went to Colombia, I think that we need to develop an exchange in Venezuela so we can be part of the solution and then engage where we don't have active conversations, structural conversations, or a process where solidarity centers or international departments, the fact that we've developed interactions, that we've gone over, that we've had discussions, then we can be in a better place to open discussions, to make suggestions, and to be part. Change needs to happen. So I am happy to be here because I'm happy to begin that process and to encourage and to kind of throw out a challenge to the Venezuelan government that we should figure out how we can get more Venezuelans here and more labor leaders, Central Labor Council presidents, international presidents, because inevitably we all work for the internationals,
right?
To be part of that discussion and that engagement. In closing, one of the things that we found to be very helpful, and this maybe we should expand this to Venezuela, is that we've had a very progressive labor council, the South Bay Labor Council, which actually runs the city of San Jose. And they may not admit that, but that's the way it is. To adopt a city in Colombia, a sister city program, and maybe that's the wrong term for it, because I don't like the way that sounds. But maybe we can develop similar arrangements with other cities in Venezuela so we can continue this dialogue and expand the discussion so we can have an impact on policy.
If I could just build on Jerry's comments. We are extremely fortunate to have progressive labor leaders like Jerry here in the Western region that has a different perspective with regard to international labor solidarity. But the reality is that for years and years and years, literally tens of millions of dollars have been funneled every year from NED, from the U.S. State Department, into the AFL-CIO, specifically to prop up the foreign policy of the U.S. government. And so that's been a very sordid and ugly history of the AFL-CIO, where the AFL-CIO was aggressively supporting the U.S. war in Vietnam, were aggressively opposing liberation movements in Central America. The AFL-CIO refused in Chile, in the Philippines, in Korea, all over the world. The AFL-CIO has historically played a horrendous role when it comes to liberation movements, when it comes to socialist progressive movements around the world, and they very much embraced a right-wing Cold War agenda in the international arena. Now, since 1995, with the new leadership in the AFL-CIO, there has been some change. And so now, within the Solidarity Center, within the International Affairs Department, there are some progressive allies in there. However, the structure and the role of the Cold Warriors within those institutions are still there. And so there has not been a thoroughgoing change in many parts of the world. And that's the challenge. So whereas here in California, the labor movement has always been more progressive, always opposed the U.S. involvement in Vietnam, has passed resolutions opposing the U.S. war in Iraq, has supported the anti-apartheid struggles, has supported liberation movements in Central America, that's not been the tendency in the national AFL-CIO. So the critical thing really is to try to identify key progressive labor leaders who can begin to institute change on AFL-CIO. I've been involved in many battles with the AFL-CIO. I just came from a labor delegation to Vietnam. And the AFL-CIO to this day refuses to have any relationships with unions of Vietnam. To this day, they refuse to have any relationships to unions in Cuba and unions in China. And it's very much part of their Cold War anti-communist framework. And in Venezuela, there's really been a horrible track record. The reality is that it's a relatively small group of people within the International Affairs Department of the AFL-CIO that set the national policy that is really below the radar screen of most union members in the country. So if you would go up to most unions in the country, they would be shocked at what the AFL-CIO is still doing in their name around the world. So that's the dilemma of the situation. There has been no public discourse on Venezuela. There's been no public debate. There's been no policy discussion. And yet, the Cold Warriors within the AFL-CIO, International Affairs Department, and the Solidarity Center are still doing what they've been doing for decades. And that's caused trouble and to support reactionary forces around the world. So that's the challenge that we have. And so I think that part of it is to really identify progressive labor leaders who are willing to make this an issue and to develop solidarity. We're going to group a few questions and then let Sharmini respond to a few. So one was on trade policies and whether Venezuela is advancing alternative models in terms of trade policies. Sister here?
I can't speak for my union, but I'm on the Human Rights Committee for the United Teachers of Los Angeles with 47,000 members, and we've just elected a progressive leadership. But three points. One, we're taking a resolution to our House of Representatives against the AFL-CIO connection with Ed. That's one thing we're trying to get passed as policy. Number two, we are dealing with privatization. We've also been dialoguing with, there's an organization, RedSepa, of teachers unions throughout the Americas, which are dealing with the same problems of privatization, textbook testing companies, ranking, all this. This is a hemispheric problem. And then also, well, if you want to get into it with us, it's either the military, Walmart, or prisons with our kids. Dumbing down of our population. We have a huge number of totally illiterate people in Los Angeles. I would like to see brigades of teachers who could, and we have a large number of bilingual teachers, with a Yosef Boyle program, just like there were brigades who went to Nicaragua and there was the Venceremos brigade that went to the Cuba, but of teachers. Mm-hmm. I can only speak for educators at this point.
That's a great idea. Yeah, it's a wonderful idea. One more question, then we'll turn it over to Charmy. Margaret?
I'm really glad for a lot of what people are saying, and also the fact that Jerry is here. We did that work as the Western Regional Director. I mean, I really think, given all that we know that the AFL has done and has been involved in Venezuela, we know that the task of people like Jerry has been huge. And the fact that he's here and supporting this meeting and the County Federation is supporting this meeting, I think is testimony to the fact that dialogue is happening and that there is some movement. For those of us in the community, because we're not organized labor, I'm part of the unwaged sector. And many of us grew up in the unions. Defend the unions, we'll continue to defend the unions, but a lot of us are really torn. You know, a lot of us are really torn with defending the unions and sometimes having to attack the unions in order to defend our class. This is really the dilemma that we're in. And it's heart-wrenching, you know, I mean, it really is very, very difficult. And it's hard when you're on the inside, when you're an organized labor, but when you're part of the unwaged sector, when you're part of the women out there, whether you're on welfare, whether you're part-time workers, I know the utility workers are now struggling with the benefits for part-time workers, what happened with the supermarket strike and that two-tier system, I mean, it is really just wrenching. And when we see a few days ago that Bush had in the White House, invited into the White House and gave a 15-minute audience to this woman who got NED money and who was involved in the coup against President Chavez, and when the millions of people came out on the street and reversed that coup, so it meant that the Bush administration, they weren't able to get away with what they pulled in Haiti, where 10,000 people have been killed in the last year with this coup that they've pulled off in Haiti, and a lot of people don't even know about the slaughter that's going on in Haiti, and Walmart is still down in there. We're really torn and really having to confront, having to defend our unions, and at the same time having to say, wait a minute, we cannot tolerate the fact that it is outrageous that State Department money, that blood money that the NED has had for decades now, has been going in the global south and undermining our revolutions. Where the money of working class people in this country are undermining our revolutions, we cannot accept that. And in this meeting today, I think that it's very good that this discussion is happening, that it is emerging, that people are making it loud and clear that the teachers union and other unions are really doing that kind of challenge to NED money, because just day before yesterday they were in the White House. And then the millions came out on the street to reverse the coup in Venezuela. They then organized the oil coup. And the union, that company union, was up to their eyeballs in that oil coup, as well as the first coup. And that oil coup was operated out of CIA offices in Venezuela. Listen, this has nothing to do with, Charmini and I haven't even discussed this. She's with the government, I'm not. You know what I mean? There's a difference with revolutionary governments and revolutionary people. So I just wanted to make that loud and clear that we know very well that it was operated out of CIA offices in Caracas, and we're not going to have it. And we wrote to President Sweeney. It's in the pamphlet at the back. We made it, it became such a long letter, and I know some of the unions now are using it as reference and challenging that whole NEB situation, because something has got to change. So as Kent said, the people who are on the inside, because we need the people on the inside, we can't tear them down. We have to support them and encourage them and give them the ammunition that they need, so that the unions could actually represent us and not wind up on the wrong side of history as happened in Venezuela. So I really just wanted to make that point that Venezuela is what we're discussing today, but there's also Iraq. And we're demanding answers, and we're going to continue to demand answers at the same time that we're going to defend our unions as representing working people. This is what, the dialectic, the dilemma, whatever you want to call it, but it's wrenching. And I just wanted to throw that out there as the discussion continues.
Okay. Why don't we turn it over to Charmini to respond to some of the comments.
I want to draw a parallel between different social movements who are taking up challenges. For example, the labor movement, who have this incredibly progressive base membership, and then you have your national organization and even the international organization like ILO or the regional body like ORIT, you know, taking up positions against, this case, Venezuela. I just want to draw a parallel with this kind of processes and human rights organizations too. It's another kind of movement, really. But human rights organizations have the same dilemma. We have Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, regional freedom of expression organizations issuing the most outrageous attacks on the Venezuelan government at the most critical moments. The Human Rights Watch released a report just before the August referendum on judicial independence in Venezuela, and that President Chavez is trying to control the judiciary and so on, just in case the referendum doesn't go his way, then he could have, you know, the absurd, there's some merit to the report. No one is arguing with that. As any country has challenges in terms of its judicial independence, in terms of the constitution, the truth is that in Venezuela, President Chavez has no control of the judiciary. I would advise him to take greater control of his judiciary because he has none. I mean, none of the judiciary is on his side. President Bush just appointed 80 people to the judiciary here at a time when Senate wasn't sitting. And these people were already adjudicating before they were confirmed by Senate. The collaboration of Human Rights Watch at this time with the opposition, it was an extension of the opposition by releasing this report. So all I'm trying to say is that other progressive so-called social movements or civil society has some of the same challenges that the labor movement is having as well, where we have bodies that are bigger than us taking positions and having policies that we may not necessarily agree with. It's a challenge for us in social movements to hold these institutions accountable through and through. I wanted to say that first. And then second, on the trade policies, Don, thanks for bringing it up, because it's a very interesting thing, I think, for the labor movement to get a hold of. While the Chavez government and the revolution has adamantly opposed neoliberalism and corporate imperialism and so on, Venezuela has a unique challenge, and that is it's a highly dependent country on the oil sector, which is dominated by multinational corporations. And yet, for it to survive, it has to depend on these. Well, they can't shut down the country. So we're in a transition. We're in a process, a transitionary process. And partly it's to get a better grip on the company itself, have it, you know, more socially responsive, etc., etc. On the other hand, how the country deals with the private sector, a more accountable process. And taxation here is the biggest one. For 40 years, multinational corporations have been in Venezuela without paying any taxes. you can actually trace it back to 60 years without paying any taxes. And not only in the oil sector, but in the mining sector. Venezuela is rich with gold, diamonds, nickels. It's got a lot of natural resources, plus ton of natural water. It's one of the fifth largest reserves of natural waters in the world, and that's becoming more and more rare commodity. So even greater interest in Venezuela, it actually makes it very scary. But these companies have paid no taxes. About 2 weeks ago, the National Assembly in Venezuela had actually released a study that found something like 25 large corporations working in Venezuela has not paid taxes, has not even the existing laws, which are very few laws that force multinational corporations to pay taxes, but even the very few laws that were there, they haven't been following these rules. So now some of these companies actually owe 20 years in back taxes. And some of them have actually fessed up and said, okay, yes, that's right, we'll pay it. Because it's better for them to pay it than have to deal with having their books unraveled and all of that stuff. But this is what they have gotten away with. The Minister for Taxation just came out and said that some individuals in Venezuela, citizens, pay more taxes than some of the multinational companies. What I cited to you earlier, that Cisneros paid $200 in taxes in 1999, none 2002. This is the reality in Venezuela. It has no tax base. It has never been enforced, and people have just taken word, or people have been bribed, so paperwork gets done. So this is the situation. It's very difficult. But there are changes coming. Daily, there are some encouraging signs. You know, the system is correcting itself slowly. Okay, what is Chavez doing that's different? Really, there's some phenomenal projects going on in Venezuela. One is putting people back in the land. There is land distribution projects. So if large companies owns idle land, determined by ownership or determined by the fact that they're not productive lands, whatever, the National Land Institute can isolate this land and put it through a process by which the studies, surveys, ownership, searches, all sorts of things done. And then it goes through a process where the National Assembly declares it national property. So property, private property, if you own more than so much land and it's sitting idle, if it goes through this process, it can be declared national land. And that land is redistributed to farmers, to indigenous people, to various people that are poor. So this is a process underway, and it is an extremely contentious one because landowners are more and more arming themselves against the institute, against the people who are prepared to occupy this land. That's a difficult situation. So that's one alternative, but this process is giving people more ownership of land. It's putting them to work. There are not the union that participated in the coup, but the new association of unions that have formed, UNITE, in Venezuela, is actually helping that sector organize, and farm workers, fisheries, etc. And so it's really encouraging that whole scheme of things. But what else is happening in terms of trade policies? Chavez has come up with real alternatives, which is so encouraging. I was just in Argentina with him, and we signed what is called an oil for milk agreement. We gave them discounted oil. They gave us 900 pregnant cows and milk. It's great. It's because we don't have cows in Venezuela producing enough milk for the population. So we signed this agreement, and Argentina was having an energy crisis last winter. So we've signed this agreement, we get milk, they get oil, and it's working fine. And Chavez has really interesting solutions to problems. You know, there's a contested territory in the Caribbean, Guyana, has had a 100-year conflict with Venezuela over some islands in the Caribbean, who owns them. At the UN level, this dispute's been going on for a century. Chavez goes to Guyana last year, and he says, look, there's no problem. I know the real problem is that, you know, everybody thinks that there's oil there. And he says, well, there may be oil there. In fact, our oil company is saying that there might be some oil in that disputed area. I don't blame you guys for wanting that because, you know, it may have oil. He goes, we have a lot of oil. We don't really need that oil. So let's just sign an agreement. We'll help you explore that contested territory. We'll sign an agreement saying that we'll help you develop those oil reserves, if there's any, for the next 30 years. So we don't have to fight over this. So instantly, in this one meeting, a 100-year dispute was settled, at least temporarily, for the next 30 years. And then he says, we'll see how it goes. He says, you need that oil. If there is oil, you need it more than we do because of the desperate situation of Guyana. And the matter was settled. And relations with the Caribbean is really developing in this way. And there's enormous amount of support for Venezuela in most of the CARICOM countries, with the exception of Trinidad, which is just 5 miles from Venezuela, that houses a huge satellite that monitors all the communication activity coming out of Caracas. But anyway, he has another plan that he has is ALBA that you raised, which is an alternative to the Free Trade Agreement of the Americas. And this is an alternative that is looking at various levels of trade and looking at really in ways of Latin American integration, encouraging Latin American conscientious business development. Again, this is a plan being developed with Cuba initially, but Brazil and Argentina and others are collaborating in this process, which is great. The other thing you need to know is that while Chavez is seen as such an anti-neoliberal personality, there was a business meeting with Argentinian business and Chilean business sector. Yeah, Lagos, the president of Chile, was just in Venezuela. And he came with something like, 350 businesses. Lagos came to Venezuela. There was a huge meeting. And at the end of the day, in this one room, there was 200 Latin American corporations listening to an address by Chavez. And he got a standing ovation from the business sector. Because what is he doing? He's encouraging Latin American companies to do business in Latin America and to do it conscientiously with certain political strife. So same thing in Brazil. In Brazil, when Chavez speaks, any place he goes in Brazil, he gets his chance, see Chavez, no Lula, chance outside. It's a little embarrassing when Lula's in the same site, but it's true. When Chavez was in Porto Alegre for the World Social Forum, in the crowd where he was speaking in the Gigantines Stadium, there was 15,000 to 20,000 people packed. And we were really encouraged by this, but only to later find out that there was another open-air stadium with 100,000 people watching him on a screen because they couldn't get into the stadium. It was incredible. I mean, his popularity is really growing in Latin America. Latin America's leaders envy his popularity. And so it's helpful for their own political career. Like right now, Lula in Brazil is being really, really supportive of Chavez. It's very critical for him, for his own electorate, to be aligned with Chavez. And he's doing that at the risk of offending the United States. And the other very interesting thing Chavez is doing is what he's calling sur-sur, south-south trade. And he's actually reviving some of the Bandung spirits and the whole concept of non-alignment. And he's trying to resurface some of those old principles of what south-south collaboration, not only intellectual, but social movements and trade and so on. And therefore is making real strides in doing trade with India, China, and other Latin American countries. And that's being done. Agreements that we are signing, whether most of them bilateral, built into them is certain labor principles that we want those foreign companies or countries to abide by. And a lot of companies are agreeing to them. China has no problems with the labor standards and requirements that we have put into our agreements. And India has had no problems with it, and so on. So a different set of standards are being built with these trade agreements. The idea of teachers' brigade, that is such a great idea. I can hook you up with some Canadian teachers' unions who are also interested in doing that.
Okay, I wanted to wrap up. I wanted to thank everybody for joining us. Thank you, Sharmini, for joining us. Thank you, Martha, for joining us.
The audio was produced by the LA Sound Posse. You can reach us on the web at www.lasoundposse.org.